Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Kara Berry, host of Everyone's Business But Mine. If you don't know me, think of me as your new friend and fellow busybody as I talk about everything under the pop culture sun, from the best way to detect a celebrity breakup or pregnancy, to recapping your favorite reality TV shows, from the Housewives cinematic universe, Welcome to Plathville, Summer House, Sister Wives, and so much more. Check out Everyone's Business But Mine, airing multiple times a week, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. How we navigate the new political environment the voters thrust upon us and the new regime that seeks to tear up the very foundations of our liberal society is a matter of ethics. And ethics is bigger than just political questions. It's about how you live, what you aspire to, and what makes for an admirable life, both inside and outside of politics. My guest today has written an important book about just that. Seth Segal is a clinical psychologist who served for nearly three decades as an assistant clinical professor at the Yale School of Medicine and is a former director of psychology at Waterbury Hospital and a former president of the New England Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. He is also a Zen Buddhist priest, and if you're a regular listener to Reimagining Liberty, you'll know how much I think Buddhist philosophy contains insights of great value in understanding our current moment. Segal's newest book is The House We Live In, which explores the crises imperiling American democracy and argues that progress depends on our arriving at a new consensus on what it means to be a good person and lead a good life, and reimagines an ethics suitable for our time. Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. If you'd like to listen to episodes uninterrupted by ads from our sponsors, you can become a supporter. You'll get my newsletter ad-free as well. To learn more, head to www.reimaginingliberty.com. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Seth Segal. We are recording this less than 2 months into the new Trump administration, and it seems to be a time when ethics is on its back foot. When it has not won out, we are not, that the world around us does not appear to be an ethical one and seems to be getting dragged in worse and worse directions. And you published this book, obviously, before this election, but you raise a lot of concerns that are now even more acute than they were when you wrote it. Why? What is it about our ethics, our ethical perspective that has gone wrong to get us there? And why do you think that a return to or an emphasis on particularly virtue traditions is the way out?
Oh, what an interesting question, Aaron. I'm not sure we've ever lived in a virtuous world. I'm reminded of the title of Reinhold Niebuhr's book in 1932, Moral Man and Immoral Society. And if you look at the history of the world, the history of all the Chinese emperors or the histories of the Romanovs or the history of the, what happened to the Athens after the fall of the Republic. So the history of the world has always been one of people bullying each other, fighting each other, warlords and others fighting for supremacy. It's been a Machiavellian world all along. And in this world, there are people like ourselves, I think, who aspire to something higher than that and something better than that. We think that there is a better way to live, a way that is marked by an acceptance or a tolerance for pluralism, the fact that we all have our own individual ideas of what might be our highest aspirations and goals and what might make us happy, and that the world functions best when we leave people to make those decisions for themselves as much as possible and not to dictate what the good is for everybody. And I think that's what liberalism is at its heart, this belief that either joyfully or ruefully, the world is a place with all different kinds of people, with all different sets of goals, and that we try as best to get along and not kill each other despite those kinds of differences. And we try to create rules of the road that enable us to live together with as little violence and strife as possible. And for those of us who have grown up within the Anglo-American tradition of liberalism, we see the democratic institutions that we have today as the best ways of securing that, of reaching compromises, of finding ways to live and let live, and turn it into a political process which is contested and always somewhat heatedly contested and occasionally devolves into civil wars. But the idea is, how can we avoid that, and how can we keep some sense of peace and commonality and a sense that we all belong to the same world together? And I think that the virtues are what enable us to do that. And I think about the virtues as really skills in living. And as I look at the ancient traditions of Greece and of China and India, I see a great deal of commonality in what those cultures recommended. People cultivate. They're skills that people cultivate so they can live skillfully and can live harmoniously with others as much as possible. So that's what I would say, is that if we're going to achieve our goals and achieve some degree of well-being in this world, and we're also going to have lives that, when we look back on them at the end of our lives, we can fundamentally approve of them and think that we did good in the world, that our presence here was for the better for those that we care about, then these are the skills that we cultivate that help us achieve those kinds of goals. And they're things like courage, or things like honesty, or things like compassion. Those are the kinds of skills that we're talking about that we develop.
To just raise one objection I can imagine people having to that project, is this: liberalism is a relatively recent, and we typically think of it, outgrowth of the Western intellectual European tradition. The thinkers that you have picked out, mm-hmm. that we should go back to reground and defend liberalism are, I mean, Aristotle is in that tradition, but Aristotle was not, ancient Greece was not a liberal society by any stretch of the imagination. Ancient China was not, Northern India at the Buddha's time was not, and we don't tend to think of these as people in the liberal tradition. And so it seems conspicuous that in order to shore up liberalism now, we need to turn to people who were not liberals and lived before the rise of liberalism. So why these guys?
Well, what I would say is that the kinds of virtues that all three of these guys, Aristotle and the Buddha and Confucius, all point to are skills that I think you would need to live in any society successfully. Whether you're talking about a liberal democracy, or whether you're talking about a warrior society or an honor society, wherever you happen to be, you need to have people who can collaborate with other people by being truthful in some kind of way, that show some kind of courage when necessary, that shows some degree of positive fellow feeling to their neighbors. And so these are all things that are needed in any society if it's to kind of last and cohere. I think it's especially important in our liberal societies, though. I have a vision of what it means to live well today in that book. And I think that the vision of what it means to live well is going to vary from society to society, depending on what the opportunities are for people to kind of maximize certain kinds of capabilities. But when you're talking about the modern industrialized Western societies of today, and also in Asia as well, I think there are a set of skills that are absolutely necessary for that.
Can you unpack flourishing? So if that's what we're aiming at. So for listeners like who aren't familiar with the virtue tradition, it's these are the traits, virtues and other traits are traits we need in order to achieve flourishing, and living them and embodying them leads us to flourishing lives. But what do we mean by flourishing?
Okay. And I think what I mean by flourishing for today's people in today's world is that we achieve some degree of satisfaction and attainment of our goals, a reasonable amount of them, that we have some degree of resilience so that when tragedy and untoward events occur, we're not totally crushed by them, that we have the capacity to appreciate things aesthetically and create aesthetically, that we have the capacity to, we have the ethical capacity to make moral judgments and live a life that other people would agree is a decent kind of life and that we would agree is a decent kind of life, that they're psychologically rich lives, that they're not shallow in any kind of way. So I think that idea of emotional satisfaction, psychological depth, a moral decency and aesthetic appreciation are kind of absolutely crucial to it. And I think when we think about today, I also think some degree of integration, not being compartmentalized so that we act one way in one situation and totally in a different way in another situation, that we're kind both to our families and to our coworkers. We're not, you know, vicious in one source, in one set of circumstances and kind in another. So that kind of integrity, I think, is important. I know there's some other things I talk about in the book as well that are not coming to mind right now, but that's the general picture I'm trying to point out, that we're effective in reaching our life goals, that we live well together with others, that we are not just individuals, but parts of communities. I see it essential to human nature that we're parts of families and communities and eventually citizens of the world as well, that we're citizens not only of the human world, but we live in an ecology that we have to honor and respect. So I think those are all different aspects of what I would call flourishing today.
As you list them, they sound, I mean, it would be hard for someone to say, no, I don't think it's good for us to have accomplishment or a sense of meaning. Like, no one's going to explicitly reject them. But it seems like there are quite a lot of people out there who don't embody those, or most of them, or many of them, who, if you asked them, they'd say, I'm having a great time. Like, I'm flourishing. So take like an Elon Musk, mm-hmm. who from the outside looks to be quite miserable in terms of all of the things that you've talked about. I don't think many of us would say, like, I'd really like my kid to live in like a ketamine induced haze, mm-hmm. and sharing hate tracks online and, you know, and destroying people's livelihoods and so on. Like, but if you asked him, he'd say, I'm flourishing. I'm living my best life. Trump would say the mm-hmm. same thing. Like, Trump does not embody these virtues, but he will tell you he's happy. Is that a concern for the project?
Yes, it is a concern for the project. So, I mean, there's always a tendency to want to say, well, we're really happy, but those people aren't really happy. I mean, look at Trump. He's always embattled. He's always embroiled. He always feels his narcissistic self is in danger of being offended. You know, he has to prop up his self-esteem. We don't think that that kind of turmoil is really happiness, but maybe he does. Maybe that's what he thrives on. So I think the trick here is Aristotle is quite clear, and this is a very contentious point. Aristotle is clear that good lives are not only lives that are happy lives, but they're lives that exhibit some kind of excellence in terms of what human beings can be. And that's always value judgment of some kind, whether a life is excellent or not. But still, I think we have to say the lives have to be not only happy, but good in some kind of way. And then we have to have some way of defining, well, what do we mean by good? Okay. And as a Buddhist, for me, good means living a life in which you're maximizing not only your own self possibilities, but the possibilities of people that you care about. And also the possibility of strangers too, that you may not care about directly, but you're applying the golden rule, let's say, in almost everything that you're doing, or something like the golden rule. So I wanted to find good in that way. And I want to say that drug lords and pimps and warlords and stuff, we don't want our children to grow up to be that way. At least I don't. And we wouldn't approve of somebody else's children if they grew up to be narcotic stealers and things like that. We have some kind of basic idea about what it means to be a decent human being, and that to flourish really means to exemplify some of that basic goodness and decency as well.
Let's get then to the virtues themselves. So the virtues are the traits of character that are mm-hmm. conducive to achieving flourishing of the various kinds. So what do these look like?
Well, they vary somewhat from tradition to tradition. So, I mean, let's just be clear that Aristotle and the Buddha and Confucius don't agree on all of these. So, for example, Aristotle is very, very big on courage. He thinks courage is an important part of that. And Plato would say justice, being a just person, is very important. Whereas the Buddha doesn't mention courage or justice anywhere in his teachings. He talks about compassion, and Aristotle talks about philia, or, you know, friendly feeling towards other people, but he doesn't really talk about compassion as an important virtue. So, well, let's recognize there are some differences between these people. But some of the skills are really very much directly related to the whole project of getting along with other people and reaching one's goals in life. So, for example, if you don't have any courage at all, how you're going to shrink from things that you might think you'll fail at, or you won't speak up when it's important to speak up, or you won't set boundaries with people when it's important to set boundaries. So just kind of growing in terms of our powers in the world and finding some way to assert ourselves in the world so that we're likely to get our needs met, that requires some degree of courage. And the same thing with Confucius and the Buddha would both say that some kind of fellow human feeling is really fundamental to everything. So Confucius calls this ren, or human-heartedness, and the Buddha calls it compassion and loving kindness and so forth. But for them, for both of those thinkers, that's the primary emotion, that we have to have some kind of caring for everyone that we interact with in some kind of way. And at least one interpretation of the way Confucius thinks about this is the golden rule, which he states explicitly at one point in one of his dialogues. You know, so the idea that we treat other people, we don't treat people the way that we don't want to be treated ourselves. You know, when Richard Rorty talks about what he thinks the fundamental moral imperative is, he says, don't be cruel. So it's another way of, I call that the Elvis Presley rule, but it's another way of expressing what's really fundamental, that you don't go out of your way to treat other people in a way that is vile and cruel and exacts pain and torment in them in any kind of sadistic way. So if you're going to be honored by other people, and other people are going to want to cooperate with you and work with you and collaborate with your goals, being someone who's seen as fair and just and someone who's honest and has some integrity, that's an important thing. When we give signals to other people that this is the kind of person we are, they're more likely to cooperate with us, work with us, and we're more likely to achieve our goals. And then there are other kinds of virtues that aren't so much interpersonal ones, things like equanimity. The ability to, when things don't quite go the way we want, not to be thrown off course, but to be able to keep some inner stability and inner calm and exert our reason in that moment and try to think about what's really the right thing to do. And then we can talk about conscientiousness, that when you're given a task to do, follow through on it, don't get distracted. You know, it's very important if you're a neurosurgeon or an air traffic controller that you are very conscientious about what you're doing and don't get lost in your goal seeking. So these are the kinds of virtues that really make a difference in terms of living together and achieving your own sorts of goals in life.
I was reminded as you were speaking of, there's the line in Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments where he says, man desires not only to be loved, but to be lovely, which I think speaks to that, like being the kind of person who is admirable to others.
That's right. That's exactly right. And if you go back to Hume's treatise on ethics too, he talks about benevolence as being his first, you know, his first virtue that he wants to emphasize. So you see this commonly throughout the tradition, not just in the ancients that we see it, but we see it in Hume and Smith and within the Christian and Jewish tradition as well. So agape is the foremost, you know, Christian virtue. When you think about chesed within the Hebrew tradition as well, they really matter. They're not just ancient philosophies.
We'll move on because I think it's probably helpful to get like the whole framework out in one piece. So we'll move on now. So we've covered flourishing, and then the virtues are necessary to flourishing, but then we also need wisdom as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And here I focus on Aristotle's idea of what he calls practical wisdom, or what in Greece they called phronesis. And that's, Aristotle says, the ability to kind of hit the mark, to kind of do the right thing in the right time, you know, at the right moment with the right people. And it's a kind of a political common sense about, if you're trying to work and collaborate with other people to reach some kind of goal, what are the interpersonal skills? What are the intellectual skills that you need to make this work? And it takes a lot of self-knowledge about yourself and how other people perceive you and what your strengths and weaknesses are. It takes a situational awareness of reading the room that you're in, and knowing what's possible and not's possible. I think here of Lyndon Johnson's Politics is the Art of the Possible. It takes ability to have a whole set of interpersonal skills about how to negotiate, how to talk to other people, how to make them think that we're really working towards a common goal together, having them trust you, establishing some sense of your trustworthiness in that situation. I mean, these are all, think about the skills a hostage negotiator needs, you know, or the kinds of needs you just need in figuring out who's going to do what kind of household tasks within the marriage, you know, the kinds of collaboration compromises that need to be made in order to make things happen. So Aristotle really emphasized that it's that all of the virtues need to be moderated in some way by practical wisdom. So, for example, courage is an important virtue, but you don't just go off rashly into battle when it makes no sense. There are times it's better to retreat, and you have to use practical wisdom to judge that. Or there are times when giving money to a charity may be the compassionate things to do, but on the other hand, it may be a scam, and maybe you have to be wise to the fact that that's not a good place to put your money in. So we talk about effective altruism in that sense. But you always need to use practical wisdom in thinking about how you're going to deploy any of these virtues in any situation. How do you build that kind of wisdom up is a question. And then we can talk about all the skills that are really involved, because it means not just the kinds of skills I talked about, the interpersonal skills and emotional intelligence skills, but it also requires, you know, just rational skills, logical skills, being able to being able to see things from somebody else's point of view, not just from one point of view, being able to take multiple factors into consideration and not just see things from the point of view of one factor. So there are a lot of intellectual, and then we can talk about all the skills that have developed in Western society over the last 2,000 years that have to do with what's logical and what's not logical.
Like, ancient philosophy has been on something of a hot streak lately, right? Like, lots of people have found themselves. So we have the cottage industry and Stoicism books. Buddhism's been, it had its pop culture moment for quite a while now. You've seen an emergence. There've been kind of like a handful of, here's how you can be an Epicurean. There's even the economist Russ Roberts wrote a life self-help book based on Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments. But there's this vibe of that kind of stuff. And I think part of it is, you know, so one question I could have asked of this project is in relation to the ancient philosophy is, we've got philosophers today who are making all sorts of arguments in favor of liberalism, from, you know, John Stuart Mill and John Rawls and people today coming up with novel arguments. But we're kind of like, what's wrong with the, why not the philosophy today? Why are we going to this outdated stuff?
I think all the philosophers of today are just as important for me. I mean, I think about the formative people for me, and I think about Isaiah Berlin, and I think of John Dewey and Ronald Niebuhr, and I think of people like John Rawls and Richard Rorty. I mean, all of these people, I think, are there's a way that Alfred North Whitehead said that all the philosophy of footnotes to Plato is footnotes to Plato. So I think we're taking up the same issues the ancients did, but we're adding new complexities and new insights and new takes on them. So I don't want to dismiss contemporary philosophy at all.
Yes, and I agree with all of that. But I do think there's a difference between contemporary philosophy and, say, Buddhism or Stoicism or the other things that are hot. And it gets into is what – so Buddhism has – you can study Buddhism as an incredibly elaborate philosophical system, and it's fascinating. Right. But what it has is also a practice. Buddhism is it says, do these things. You want to instill these virtues. Here's how. Sit down and do this. Versus contemporary philosophy will describe what it means to be moral, what it means to be ethical, but it's less interested in like a practical method of practice than the ancients seem to have been.
Right. So, you know, Pierre Hadot written this book years ago about philosophy as a way of life. And one thing that separates the Epicureans and the Platonists and the Stoics and so forth from contemporary philosophy is that they were interested in philosophy is not a question about how do we know what we know so much as a question of how do we live our lives. And you're right, they offer practical ways of embodying those virtues. So Aristotle talks about practice as mean, as the main way to kind of learn these virtues. Or Confucius talks about both practice and studying ancient texts. You know, what have wise people in the past said about what we ought to do? And then Buddhism offers things like meditations, whether it's mindfulness meditation or loving kindness meditation or compassion meditation, so forth. There's a way of kind of building up the inner resources for that. So I think you're right. To a large extent, we haven't developed newer ways or better ways of instilling these kinds of virtues within our contemporary society. It used to be, I think, that school, when I went to public school back in the ancient days, there was a much larger emphasis on civics and on a common cultural core that, you couldn't do it now, but every assembly we had every week started with a Bible reading. Okay. We were, the community was half Jewish and half Catholic that I lived in. So we always picked things from the Old Testament rather than the New Testament, so everyone could agree on them. But still, we would read a psalm at the beginning and so on. So there was much more of an emphasis on enculturation, I think, and it was acculturation within a liberal culture. I remember that the name of the book that I wrote is The House We Live In, and I took that from a song that was written back in the 1940s. But my social studies teachers in elementary school used to play that record of The House We Live In, which talked about all races and religions contributing to, that's what democracy is to me, you know. We got a lot of education in that way. I'm not sure that people still do quite the same way. But I think there was more agreement back then within civil society, at least within the northern cities, for example. There's more agreement about what it meant to be a good citizen than there is today. I want to talk about a topic here that I haven't brought up yet. Okay, I mean, society is always infinitely complex, okay, with all kinds of philosophical and psychological and economic and sociological and demographic things going on, right? Technological changes, science advancing, and so forth. So society is always changing from something to something else. And that change always causes some degree of dissent and disagreement. How much should we change? You know, are we changing the right direction? Let's go back to the way things used to be. That kind of combat. That's what we're engaged in right now in the United States, is a combat about how much change. Have we gone too far in change? Let's go back to the way things were back in the day of the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow, whatever it is that we're going back to. The question I have now is the rate of change accelerated now because of science, because of technology, and so forth? And are societies changing faster than they can accommodate and develop new sets of norms to kind of deal with the issues that come up as a result of that change? So I think about the way the American family has changed since the 1950s, for example, how fewer people are getting married, how fewer people are having children, the number of children is declining, more families are one-parent families, or if the two parent families, both members are working. My mother stayed home until I was seven, you know, and that's the way it was in the old days, right? The amount of change and the amount of change in sex roles has been enormous during this time. And people used to be, you live near your family, your extended family. Now who does that anymore? I mean, I've moved across the country how many times? And nobody in my family of origin lives in the state that I'm in right now, although it used to be we were all one very tight group and we saw each other every week. How does society deal with those kind of changes? You have to kind of create new sets of norms, new sets of expectations, new sets of roles that people agree on. And how long does that take for that to occur? And if things are changing that rapidly, is there ever any time to catch up so you can reach any kind of general agreement or consensus again? I think this is a terrific problem that we're dealing with.
So you have hit upon the core of my philosophical and political project for the last several years, which has been on this. And I think it is the case that change has triggered us into the world we now find ourselves. I'm a little bit uncertain about whether it's the pace or it's the awareness of change that has increased, because we now have mechanisms to know about change happening everywhere in the world versus just the change we're seeing in our immediate lives. And so there's the appearance of more change, even if the pace hasn't necessarily shifted. So I don't know where the balancing is. And I think a similar story exists for diversity, that there are people kind of upset by seeing diversity it's not necessarily there's more diversity in the world. It's just that now you're much more aware of it because you have these devices that are telling you about all these weird things weird people are doing all over the place. And it's like in your face.
Yeah. Although there is the very real issue of a kind of a European descent Christian majority that used to be able to perceive itself as the norm for society, now seeing itself perhaps in eventually becoming a minority, or at least becoming just a small majority in a very plural society. That's a real change in terms of status and in terms of status risk and anxiety that produces.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you can tell a pretty compelling story about most everything that's happened over the last 10 or 15 years through just mechanisms of relative status, status anxiety, shifting status, and so on, mm-hmm. of different groups of men compared to women, of whites compared to minorities, of native-born versus immigrant, and just kind of rising and lowering status of different professions, traditionally male professions versus service industry. It's all caught up. And we know, you know, like, so Karen Stenner has done good work on the psychology of authoritarianism. We know there are people who have an innate kind of authoritarian personality type, and that doesn't mean they're political authoritarians at any given moment, but they can get triggered into it by essentially witnessing too much diversity and change for whatever their level of permissiveness is. And this is actually where, like, so my version of Buddhist liberalism is kind of taking this on head on, which is, I think, the core and correct insight of Buddhism is that we suffer because we cling or try to force permanence upon things that are impermanent, ourselves and everything else around us. And then when we lose mm-hmm. whatever we demanded was permanent, that's painful. And so the way out of suffering is to adjust your perspective and understand impermanence at a very, very deep level and the ubiquity of it and the ubiquity mm-hmm. of change. And I think that much of the illiberalism and the issues that you identify in the book of populism and nationalism and racial animus and all of this stuff is ultimately just change aversion. It is, I want things to be one way and I don't like that they're another way. I don't like that they've either changed or I don't like that I'm seeing other things that aren't like that. So diversity and dynamism, which are necessary features of the world, you can't will those away. Even in your authoritarian North Korean, there's dynamism in North Korea. And so what happens is, on the one hand, you try to use politics to stamp out dynamism and diversity, which inflicts harm and suffering on the people whose dynamism and diversity you're stamping out. And that's morally wrong to inflict. This gets to the, like, cruelty and exclusion and everything else. But also, it makes you miserable because you're demanding something of the world it can't give you, and then getting really mad when the world gives you the only thing it can, which is diversity and dynamism. And so, as a result, I think if we mm-hmm. take this Buddhist insight seriously, it both shores up a liberal society because it stops, it undercuts the main forces pushing against it. And it also makes us individually happier within it. Because if you can accept the dynamism and diversity that a liberal society necessarily entails, rather than being dispirited by it or despondent about it, you'll be happier. And if you can move on to embrace, not just like tolerating it, but finding delight in it, a sympathetic joy of, you, Seth, might be living a life that I wouldn't choose for myself, but it's making you happy and that makes me happy, then like the diversity and dynamism becomes part of my own happiness and contentment just by its nature, by people being able to live out their own lives.
So I agree with that sentiment entirely. As a Buddhist, I totally concur. And I want to raise another question. That's good for you and it's good for me. But how many people can live that way? What, you know, how do you find first of all, can everybody live that way? You know, how many people constitutionally are able to accept that degree of change and flux and take joy in it? And I'm just raising as a question. I'm not sure the answer. I'm looking at what's happening right now in this country. And what I see is an erosion of support for democratic norms. So that my guess is that at least 40% of the population, and perhaps more, thinks that what the country really needs in this moment is a strong man who is willing to kind of destroy everything that's happened before and impose his will on things. And if it breaks a lot of laws and breaks, well, like Lenin said, if you want to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs, right? So I think there's not an awareness among a part of a large part of the population that the rule of law and having procedures and policies and doing things through slow compromise is actually the better way of doing things. They're not aware of how they might be hurt by the absence of that yet. That's a concern I have. I don't see a lot of support around the country, or for at least in the large segments of the country, for the kinds of values that I'm espousing and that I think that everyone would be happier if they could espouse. And maybe there are limits to how much people can live in the world in which they don't feel at home. It's not the one they grew up in some kind of way. That's a hard adjustment for a lot of people to make. I mean, the world that I grew up in is totally gone. I mean, I'm thinking about just the neighborhood I grew up in, where there was, like I said, it was half Jewish and half Italian, and there was a synagogue just about in every block, and an appetizing store where you could go into the Barrel and pick out pickles, and you know, kosher bakeries, and you go to temple and half those people were speaking Yiddish. I mean, that's an old world that has no existence anywhere anymore. And I think a lot of people have that feeling that the place I grew up with, you know, the farm I grew up in, or the little community I grew up in, or the little, or the steel and coal mining town I grew up in, you know, those don't exist anymore. And yeah, we can tell people, yeah, go ahead and adjust to change, you know, live in change, thrive in change. This is capitalism, creative destruction, as Schumpeter said, right? This is what we live in now. But there may be limits to what people can really do. And there may be extent at which social cohesion really begins to break down under too much of that. And maybe we're at that point. I don't know where we go from here. I'm reminded of something that Rorty wrote. He had a book out in 89 called Irony, Contingency, and Solidarity. And in it, he had a chapter on George Orwell and what he got out of 1984 as a book. And he said, what I got out of it was that all the things that we value as liberals today, you know, the idea of tolerance for others, the idea of not being cruel, the idea of representative governance, all these were some fictions that people came up with, you know, just by contingency, by happenstance in England and somewhere in the 17, 1800s. It says they just appeared out of a whole, concatenation of events. So, and they could just as easily disappear tomorrow. That's what Orwell tells us. That the rulers who come up tomorrow, you know, may not have the same values, may have different perspectives. Maybe the world we're trying to hold on to so desperately, this democratic world, maybe it's going to be gone. And maybe we're going back into another period like during the fall of the Roman Empire, where you just have, you know, one bad emperor after another being picked out by the army and then being assassinated again. It's not clear where we're going, but we're always going somewhere else. The world is always changing. I want to hold on to these values as much as I can. I'm convinced this is the better way for human beings to live. But I may be fighting a lost cause, and I'm acutely aware of that.
I hope we're not fighting a lost cause, because this stuff matters. This stuff matters a lot. But I think that is why arguments like the ones that you make in your book are valuable, because there's a comprehensiveness to the vision of it. And what I mean by that is, often the way that we talk about liberalism, or we talk about like what it is, what a liberal society is we talk in terms of kind of just institutions and rules. So a liberal society is one that has certain kinds of governing institutions, and it has certain rules, rules of law, separation of powers, whatever it happens to be. And those are all really important. You know, that's the, like, if there's some number of people who kind of can't tolerate a liberal society, you want your institutions and laws structured to basically minimize the damage those people can do if they're an inevitable feature. And so we want to protect rights. We want to give people the ability to exercise the freedom in the ways that you've talked about. That's all really important, but it has to be viewed in the context of like liberalism. To go back to your philosophy as a way of life, like liberalism is a way of life. And the reason you're a liberal is not just because you accept, you say, like, I support these institutions and these set of rules, but because you have a set of values that you embody, that govern your relations to others, the perspective you take on the society and the people around you, and that set point to a certain set of institutions. Like, the reason that you support those institutions is because they're what cash out of liberal values. How do we prevent the world from going in even darker directions? I think this is the value of, like, the practice side of it, is showing people, like, here's how you can get there, and taking seriously the concerns that they have. So this loss of meaning seems to have played a role in what's transpired. And the problem is not that people have said, I don't need meaning in my life. It's that they're seeking meaning in corrupt places. And so I think it's, I mean, I think that's on, like, that's on us as liberals, is to, like, make our pitch in a way that is appealing, and to show why this is more, yes, you're into this thing now, but if you were into this thing instead, you'd be happier. Your life would be more flourishing. Here's how it can be more flourishing. And it's not, it's like, run away from the, because there's a kind of stripping liberalism of values argument, that there's no like positive virtue claims in liberalism. It simply is like a set of negative rights and so on. And I think we, and I think your book's an example of this, have to provide like a more compelling alternative.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly John Dewey's view of democracy too. It's not a set of institutions, but it's a way of looking at life, which is a way of collaborating with other people with the aim of having everyone in the community flourish as much as possible. Everyone be able to achieve their own degree of self-actualization and happiness according to what they think makes them happy. And then you can come into the other criticism that you're just mentioning, which is that some of the values that get promulgated by society don't really make people happy if they pursue them. So, I mean, a lot of people discover that. They launch themselves in one direction in life and at some point find they're not really happy with the choices that they've made and they need something else. And we see all these mid-career changes where, you know, people drop out of some kind of financially lucrative area, become something more humanistically oriented. You know, they become teachers or social workers or writers and so for artists and so on. And I think this is, as a psychologist, this is where there's a lot of good psychological research and what really helps people to flourish. So I'm thinking of an older study I read in 2008 in which they had college students keep diaries over the course of a period of a month about their activities, whether they were doing things that were just selfish activities that might please them, like buying jewelry or getting high or going to parties, having sex, masturbating, and so forth. Or there were more eudaimonic kinds of activities like listening to a friend, loaning money to a cause, helping to tutor somebody, and so forth. And then they looked at the end of that 2 month period of the students' well-being, how happy were they, how meaningful were their lives, and so forth. And what they found was that the number of self-satisfying activities they engaged in had nothing to do with the ratings of happiness at the end of 2 months or the ratings of meaning, but the number of caring activities they did that involved other people had an enormous effect on how they felt about themselves. So it's this idea that whoever acquires the most toys before they die wins, that idea is really going to make you happy. That's not true. And it's a truism too, that we say that when you're in your deathbed, do you want to say, I wish I had spent more time in the office? Or do you want to say, I wish I spent more time with my family? What is it that people say on their deathbed, so to speak? So we have to have that perspective about what is it that really enriches your life? What is it that really makes you happy? And are the goals that you're pursuing right now that the society says you ought to do if you're going to be successful, are those really the ones that contribute to well-being? It's a crucial question.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad, a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news.
We're watching.
Fashion trends. Pep talks where we give advice.
Mental health moments.
And games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.